Hey, what's going on? Welcome to The Doug Show. I'm Doug Cunnington, and today I'm talking to Justin Peters. How are you doing today?
I'm doing excellent, man. I'm so excited for this conversation.
Yeah, we connected not too long ago, and I think we just passed each other in hallways for several years, but we never met each other until like a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And I think we have a ton in common. So I was like, yep, got to have you on the show. And you're the co-founder of Simple Pod Studios. That's a podcast production agency. So we're going to talk a lot about, you know, running an online business and running an agency, the challenges, the beginning, the growth, and all that kind of thing. So I want to start just with a little background on you, who you are, and what you do, and you can give us a little history, and I'll leave it open for you to answer however you want.
Sure. So my podcasting journey started 6 years ago. I was a solo podcast hobbyist for a couple of years. This project started out of a self-made sabbatical, and I'm too type A to do nothing during a sabbatical. So I said, hey, you know what? Let me try to start a podcast. I always liked consuming podcasts. I wanted a creative outlet. So I started a podcast. I didn't think I would continue with it. I definitely didn't think I'd start a business around it. But even as I re-entered the workforce, I continued podcasting. And then about a year and a half into my journey, I realized I didn't really love podcast production. I didn't like the editing process. I love the conversations. I love the research. I love the input that goes into creating a podcast. But all of the work that came with it was challenging. So I was seeking for some help. And sure enough, my brother reached out, and he comes from a audio engineering background, and said, hey, I'll help you out. Your audio sounds terrible. I can definitely help you. And that was really the genesis of Simple Pod Studios. I realized working with him that he could probably also help other podcast friends that I have. So I started making introductions to some people I knew that he could help. I had so much fun kind of helping him start his freelance editing business that I eventually went to him and I said, hey, can we do this together? Sure enough, about 4 or 5 years ago, we started Simple Pod, and it's grown into what it is today.
Can you give us an idea of the general revenue, the profits, or maybe more generally, just like the scope of the business?
Sure. This year, we're on track to do about $180,000. About a third of that goes out into cost. Most of our cost, probably say about 90% of our cost, is contract cost. We have 2 full-time contract editors that work for us and help produce shows that we manage. And then the rest of the profit is split 50-50 between Kyle and I. And just in terms of general scope size, right now we're working with about 18 podcasters. Some of those podcasters on a seasonal basis, some of those podcasters are launching their shows, so they're not quite in full production. And then some of these podcasters we've been working since the very beginning. And we do everything from simple editing with them to full production. So we'll handle both the editing, along with someone has to write the show notes, create the thumbnails, get it posted, help with social media content, deal with technical issues, communicate with guests. So we'll do all of the full package for a couple of clients as well.
Gotcha. Very cool. And thanks for sharing all the details. This is from the behind the scenes. I let you know that I was going to ask, and you could dodge questions. You could do what you need to. But because a lot of people are not going to share revenue, it's some, you know, trade secrets or something like that. But that's awesome. Now, it's a tough business model. Like you said, like you started it because you did not want to be editing podcasts. And I'm with you. I love the idea of sculpting a wonderful arc of an episode, but the nuts and bolts of doing that are, I just don't have the motivation to do it at this point. So can you talk a little bit about the team and all the folks that, you know, may be involved in production? And you said you have 2 full-time, but who all do you have on the team?
Yep. So Kyle, my brother, and I co-founded the business. We're both working members. So we take on probably about 50% of the workload on both sides of the house. He is, I would consider, the director of production. So as soon as an episode is recorded and moves into the production process, he pretty much handles the entire workflow and responsibility all the way through marketing a podcast episode. And then I get all the other ancillary tasks that come with that, sales and marketing, client services, finance, and kind of general business operations. So I get to handle a lot of a lot of random fun things that pop up. And then we have two full-time editors. They both report to Kyle. Kyle's in charge of overseeing their workload, the workflow itself, their performance, etc. Our editors are editing the shows. They're writing, doing a lot of copywriting for our clients, and then any of the ancillary tasks, like I said, making thumbnail graphics, etc. So that's mostly the dynamic of our team. We have a couple of contractors that come in and out, especially graphic designers or audio engineers. If we have like repair work that we have, we get a really bad episode. But outside of that, it's mostly a pretty lean team between Kyle, myself, and the two editors.
All right. What was your corporate job?
I worked in operations, actually, for a Fortune 500 company. So it was very interesting. Actually, I think we talked about this a little bit. I left that job. I started a self-made sabbatical, like I mentioned. I started podcasting out of there. I didn't think I'd start a business out of it, so I re-entered the workforce. And actually, my old employer ended up rehiring me about 4 years ago. So I ended up working for them and then slowly went from full-time to part-time as I scaled up my business too and started working more and more full-time in my business. But it was nice. I actually really liked that approach. It gave me some security on the back end. It also allowed my brother to step full-time in the business. And if there was ever a month that cash flow just didn't make sense, we could pay him first and then I could get paid second, which was great. I could invest a little bit of the money I was making in my W-2 for that. And I carried a lot of skill sets from that job, you know, project management, creative problem solving, communication, sales. A lot of these things I learned in this corporate environment, and I didn't have to learn on the fly as an entrepreneur. It's already such a tough journey. So I'm glad I actually ended up working for that Fortune 500 company, but I'm also very glad that I get to do this full time now too.
That's really cool that you took the sabbatical, number one. So how did you manufacture that?
Left the employer that I was mentioning and went to a competitor. And I was thinking grass was greener on the other side. I was a little burnt out in my career. I just thought I needed an employer change. And I realized whenever I made that change, it was even worse. And I probably tell people 3 weeks in, it was, or 3 months in, it was probably actually about 3 weeks in that I knew that this job wasn't going to stick. But I did the whole dog and pony show. I was moving into a sales role too, which was even more challenging. So I posted on LinkedIn that I had this big job change. If you need help or support, reach out to me. I was already networking a bunch. And then here I am 3 months into this job, like, ugh, this is not what I want to do. But the problem was I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I came out of a really great conversation with a career coach. And he told me, Justin, why don't you just create some white space for yourself? Like, you told me about your financial situation. Instead of like trying to jam another job in there and see if it works or not, just create some white space for yourself. Take a sabbatical. And as somebody that had been working since they were 14 years old and never even thought about taking a sabbatical, let alone a sabbatical in my 20s, I was like, whoa, that's a novel idea. It took me 2 more months to actually implement that, but I left that job and then created a 7-month mini retirement sabbatical, whatever language that you want to use for this. And I'm so glad I did it. Cause like I said, the first half of that, he gave me some really good advice. He said, don't think about whatever job, don't apply for jobs. Don't try to like have networking conversations, take 3 months to do you to, and one of the biggest pieces of advice he told me is work on a project that you've always wanted to do, but never had time because of work. And 8 months before that conversation, I'd bought 2 Blue Yeti microphones with the intent of starting a podcast. I set them up on my shelf and there they sat on my shelf for 8 months. So as soon as he gave me that piece of advice, I knew it was starting a podcast was gonna be what I was gonna spend those first 3 months on. So yeah, it was honestly serendipity that I had that conversation with him. He planted that idea in my head. I was a little bit lost in my career, but I was also financially stable enough that I could take some time off.
How hard was it for you to chill out? Because it sounded like you're pretty driven. So how did you keep that under control?
Yeah, I don't know if I did it well, to be honest. Like I said, I started a podcast 6 days into my sabbatical. So I don't know if that would necessarily be good at chilling out. But I did try to build a little bit of structure around my days. I knew I wanted to read every single day, run every single day, and work on my podcast every single day. And that was the only requirements that I had for myself. And if I got those things done and it was 1:30, then on a Tuesday, I would allow myself the flexibility, the freedom to go out and do anything else that I wanted. So I don't know if I was great at chilling out. I still had to put some structure behind it. But I do think having a more simplified and shorter to-do list allowed me to feel like I could check the boxes of my type A personality, but also allowed me to really spend probably the second half of the day chilling out or doing what I wanted to do.
Sounds like you were an avid and are an avid podcast listener. What were the shows that inspired you through the years?
The very first show I ever listened to was the Jordan Harbinger show. I just loved Jordan. I loved how he conducted interviews. I really fell in love with just audio learning in general. Actually, audio learning started to me before that. I started working for this company. I was 19 years old. It was an insurance brokerage. So as you can imagine, at 19, I was two times, maybe three times less in terms of age on most of the people I was talking to. And I was getting bored of always having the same conversation about weather or about kids. And I was like, man, what do these people like to talk about outside of that? And like politics or current news, things like that was something that came up a lot. But I had no, as a 19-year-old, I had no investment. I had no idea what was going on. So I started listening to talk radio on my drives into work. I listened to NPR a lot. NPR guided me to podcasting. Then I got introduced to Jordan Harbinger and some other podcasters at the time, like Tim Ferriss, and just consumed so much in that space. But since then, I've branched out a ton. I love niche shows now. Anytime I want to tackle a topic, I usually go to podcast players first and see who's creating in the space.
And when you started your show, what was your show? And then, how did you approach it? Because it's like, I mean, there's a lot. You could cover anything, and it sounds like you have a lot of interests.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, looking back and now as a podcast coach, I did probably like all the wrong things starting my show, but I did one right thing, which was just get it started. Like at the end of the day, like if you're thinking about starting a podcast, just get going. You're probably not going to find your voice. Definitely not until episode 20, probably closer to episode 100. Like it just takes reps, takes time, and you'll start figuring out this is who I like to talk to. This is what I like to talk about. This is who my audience is. This is what they're attracted to. But the initial concept of my show, the show was called The Struggle Is Real, and it was exploring topics that I wish were taught in college, but weren't. I came out of college and thought it was going to prepare me for all the things that young adulthood threw my way, but realized that was not the case. I felt kind of like I was sold this bag of goods that actually didn't deem fruitful. So here I was at 26 years old starting a podcast, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to cover relationships, health and wellness, personal finance, some of these other big topics. And of those categories, the most response and the most amount of questions I typically got were about personal finance, about money, money management, and anything in that realm. And I kept just creating more and more based on audience feedback. And eventually, The Struggle Is Real turned into a personal finance show. And I eventually rebranded it to FI Minded or FI Minded, which is a personal finance show with a financial independence tilt.
Before we get into more agency stuff, we both have a strong interest in the FI community. So when did you get introduced to FI and perhaps FIRE and all that stuff?
Always came from a frugal upbringing. I was lucky that my dad always taught me probably core personal finance tenets. So I was always a pretty good saver. As soon as I started working, I knew about getting my 401k match and investing, and I always lived within my means. So I think I had a pretty good foundation, but I never had a reason why. Like outside of just like take care of yourself and don't be a burden on society. Like that was the line my dad was feeding me. I was like, yeah, it just wasn't like a strong why for me until I picked up the book, I Will Teach You to Be Rich, and started reading through that and got introduced to financial independence, financial freedom, and this concept of being able to live off a nest egg as you build it. And maybe even potentially only working for 15 or 20 years and not having to wait till 65 to be retired. So I think that probably happened around 2017, 2018. I don't know the exact year, but I got super excited about financial independence and of course drank the Kool-Aid pretty quickly and doubled down on a lot of what this community has to offer.
Okay. And then did you have like a target of like, hey, I want to retire by a certain date like folks do?
Yep.
Okay. So yeah, talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. 5 by 40 was always my mantra. I felt like that was a good age. I just kind of picked that number between compound interest calculator / where I felt like I'd be in my life, kids and relationships and et cetera. I felt like I'd love to reach financial independence by 40. And it's cool to say, I'm not 100% to my financial independence number. I've actually moved into what people call Coast Fi at this point in time. I'm not really aggressively pursuing financial independence, but I do consider myself pretty much financially independent. And I just turned 33. So I think I checked the box on 5 by 40.
Very good. Yeah. And I think some of the early bloggers were a lot more aggressive. My old podcast co-host Carl Jensen, his blog was 1500 days. So he was like trying to do it in under 4 years from when he discovered the concept. And, you know, later on we hear like, oh, taking a little bit longer. And maybe, I mean, you have created your own business and, you know, you're a co-founder, you're the boss. And that's probably way more fulfilling and potentially like a lot more valuable, like in the long run, both financially and just for our mental health and, you know, psychology around the whole thing. So very cool. Congratulations. It definitely like it allowed you to take the sabbatical, I suspect, and it allowed you to be selective and do the part-time work. So
definitely. Yeah. And it's interesting because I consider myself financially independent. And I always thought it had to be the nest egg number, the 4% rule that would get me there. But I'm reading Cody Berman's book right now, Retire by 30. And he puts another concept in there called cash flow. And I never thought about it, but the reason why I haven't necessarily been as aggressive on my financial independence journey right now is I got this big nest egg over here, and then all the rest of my expenses are really just paid through SimplePod. And I love SimplePod, and I don't see it going away. So I kind of like lost interest in continuing to build that nest egg because I'm like, I don't know if I really need any more money right now. And it's nice because they can kind of play a part, and we'll probably talk about this a little bit. I don't have to be as aggressive with my business either. I don't have to take on clients I don't want. I don't have to do or expand scope of services to expand revenue. There are a lot of things that I get to do and build a more of a lifestyle business because I'm pretty taken care of on both sides of the aisle right now.
Funny enough, I was literally just talking to Cody, so he'll be the preceding episode.
Nice. This one.
So we'll get into starting the agency. And basically, I mean, this is a classic thing that happens where you're starting your show, you realize that you should outsource a portion of it. You've trained people, conceivably, or you've put together a team and you can outsource that portion of it. So you realize, hey, I can, you know, whatever, slap on the overhead and the margin so that it's profitable. And all of a sudden you have an agency and then you don't have to do the work that you don't want to do. So I summarized that accurately, correct?
I think it's a great summary. Okay. It's a great summary. Like I said, there was no intention of building a business. It was just a problem I needed to solve. And then I realized I could solve this problem for my other podcast friends. And sure enough, other people outside my circle also wanted support and help.
Okay. So yeah, what were the first clients? And you said you had friends that were podcasters. So how'd you meet these friends and talk about figuring out who you wanted to work with and who you didn't want to work with?
Yeah. So I had podcast friends that I've made just through podcasting. We do a lot of guesting. So I ended up meeting a lot of people, but actually our very first client ran a show called Military Money Manual. I actually still produced that show. And it was two guys, Jamie and Spencer, and I met them at a conference. And that worked out really well, actually. I realized a lot of business gets done at conferences or at networking events or at local events. So I doubled down on that as a kind of primary method of finding new clients. And actually probably I would say 2 out of 5 clients end up coming to us via live events or like in-person events. So we started working with them. Actually, prior to that, we took on one of our friends as a temporary client. We traded a opportunity to produce his show for free so we could dial in our workflows and get some feedback from him. And in return, he got 5 episodes edited for free from us. And we got a refer or we got a recommendation out of it as well. So we took the summer to work on his show, to dial in some of our practices, along with producing our own show that we were working on at the time. And then in August, we signed Jamie and Spencer as our very first client.
Very cool. How did you figure out the pricing and packages? And, you know, it's so hard to figure that stuff out.
Trial and error, Doug. This was one of our big mistakes, man. I wish I had a better strategy outside of sell it once, raise the price, and sell it again, and see kind of where it landed. Our very first client, we sold episodes at $40 per episode, which is insanely low, especially as we started to realize we didn't want to be the ones editing the shows as well. Luckily, Kyle was editing the shows whenever we very first started. You think about $40 an episode split between 2 people after cost, very, very thin margins there, didn't get us super excited. So we had to quickly increase our prices. And like I said, a lot of that was trial and error. I would continue to raise them, usually just like add $25 or $50 onto that price until I got a no. And then once I started getting some more consistent no's, I felt like I was maybe in range. Going back, I probably would have done a little bit more competitor analysis. But there, honestly, when we were getting started, the podcast production agency space wasn't as populous as it is now. So I didn't really have a lot of references for how much outside of just going to Fiverr and kind of looking up what other people were charging. And that's kind of where we got to the $40 to start with. Just didn't work in an agency model for us. So we had to quickly change pricing.
Okay. And then how about the packages? So that obviously it's all hand in hand and, you know, things have changed a lot in the last 5 years. Basically, it's like show notes, there's video, there's other stuff. So yeah, where did it start and how did you tweak it along the way?
Yeah, this is definitely a big evolution for us and honestly continues to be a big evolution for us as well as we try to figure out what is most important for our clients and also what we should just handle for our clients. Like not even what they think is important, but what we know is important through our expertise and knowledge. But yeah, this was an evolution. We honestly said yes to our clients a lot. Like we would sell editing to start with, and then they would, a lot of times our clients would ask us, hey, could you also do this? So the first year was just a year of yeses. And we would just say, yeah, we could do that. And we would add it to the package. We'd price it out. I usually add like 10 or 15 bucks on as they like slowly added things into their package. We'd try it out. We'd figure out the best way to work that into our workflow. And ultimately decide, do we want to continue offering this or not? And we made some mistakes. There were some things that I realized I do not want to include in packages, regardless of how much someone pays us. For example, one of those is social media management. We had a client ask us if we could manage their social media for them. We said yes right away and then quickly unbundled that and realized this is not what we want to do. It's not my expertise. It's not where I want to play. It's a competitive domain. It required a lot of hoops to jump through. So we ended up running it as a trial with them for 3 months. Luckily, I was smart enough to know, hey, I don't know if we want to take this on yet, but we're down to try to take it on for 3 months. At the end of the 3 months, we told them, hey, this actually isn't what we want to do. But the smart thing that I did was in that 3 month period, because we knew after month one, we did not want to continue this. I went out and networked with someone that is really good at this. So I was able to offer a solution for them after all of it was said and done and say, hey, we don't want to do it, but I have someone that's willing to do it and they'll bolt onto our process so that it feels very seamless for you. And that's worked well in terms of service offerings that we don't feel comfortable doing or we don't want to do so that we can stay in our lane in terms of just being podcast experts.
From the podcast expert standpoint, how important is the social media piece?
Man, that's a loaded question. I think it can be very important or not important at all. And part of it depends on the client itself. Most of our expertise lies in professional service providers, specifically coaches, advisors in the financial planning or financial coaching space. And if they have an existing audience, they are already creating organic content for social media, it can be a great bolt-on. It can be a great addition if we can start to overlap podcast audience and social media audience. If they have no interest in that whatsoever, they don't plan to do anything outside of podcast repurposing content for social media, I think it can typically be a money pit for a lot of service providers. So I think it's a case-by-case basis for most clients.
Cool. Great answer. And, you know, I don't really like social media myself. So yeah, I'm like,
what's your strategy? Do you participate in social media?
Just for fun. I like, you know, puppies and guitars. So like my feed is kind of filled with that stuff. Stand-up comedy as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, from the marketing side, just it's a choice that I've made. And through the years of me like working online, like stuff can work for certain people. Timing is really important. There's a lot of other factors. Nothing is quite as easy and it shifts all the time. Yes. So at some point I was like, I'm out. You can do social media and it can help your show grow, but probably the effort and resources are better spent like being on other shows or just like some pure networking is what it comes down to, and word of mouth.
Yeah.
It's just really hard to like manufacture the viral stuff, even though some people will say, oh, I have the formula and I can guarantee it. It's like, maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. So definitely.
It's just an excuse for being to not put in the time.
And I think that's a decent excuse. I think as long as you're intentional with the decision and that you're not just thinking you have to be on social media and then you do it half-heartedly and then you burn yourself out or add additional workflow that is not paying off whatsoever, I think an intentional decision is something that I try to push our clients into making whenever it comes to social media.
Something we haven't highlighted yet, but I really want to spell it out and get your sort of history on it. But you mentioned that you're kind of in the financial space. Is that accurate? Like all the clients are in that space.
Yep.
So obviously those folks can charge a lot and they earn a lot of money. The finance space is a good one to spend time in. Maybe one that's not as profitable would be, I'm just going to make one up, like, dog walkers or something like that. That is high dollar, noble thing. I love dogs and it's good to walk outside and all that stuff, but they're not going to have as much profit margin to hire a podcast editor and agency to produce and run their show. So was that super intentional where you were like, these people make a lot of money and they will, like one client, one conversion is worth tens of thousands of dollars and they may only have whatever, 100 downloads per episode or 50 or whatever. And if they get one conversion, it pays for a couple years of your service. So talk about that decision.
Definitely. At the end of the day, we have to provide ROI for our clients, or this has got to be a very short relationship with clients. And a little bit of this was organic because I had a personal finance podcast. I love personal finance. And I attended a lot of in-person personal finance conferences and events. So I naturally started to meet a lot of advisors or tax prep people, etc. I also think their expertise lends really well to the medium of podcasting. And I think it's a space that grows very well outside of like dog walking. I'm not really sure how many people are like looking for dog walking podcast out there, probably like dog training podcast are out there, I'm sure. But it just seemed like a space that translated well. So many of these coaches and advisors also don't love social media, but they're looking for a way to market their services. There's an endless amount of opportunity to create episodes around this. And then yes, at the end of the day, if a lifetime value of a client for them is somewhere in the range of $50,000 to $75,000, and we can help them pick up even one client every single year, we can figure out a way to make ROI and pay back our services pretty easily.
by the time people come to you, they've already decided they want to start a show, kind of, or where in their podcast life cycle might they find you?
Yeah, either one of two places. They are considering launching a podcast, so they're coming for us for our launch services, and we have like a 8 to 12 week launch package that we walk them through, white glove, handheld, or they're an existing podcaster. Sometimes we're poaching them from another service provider that just isn't up to par, and they're looking for a new editor or new production team. Other times they've been running it solo on their own or with their team, and they're realizing their team doesn't have the expertise to be able to produce a podcast, or they might be frustrated about growth, anything else in that realm. So we'll pick up existing or potentially new podcasters.
Okay. So I think that was three of different categories. Which is the best client to have from your observations?
ones that are able to follow a process and be deadline oriented. At the end of the day, like, that is the kind of client that I'm really looking for. I like, if you were to put a gun to my head, I probably would say I like existing podcasters more than people that are interested in launching a podcast. It's very hard for me to articulate the workload and time and effort that goes into podcasting. But I know if an existing podcaster comes to me, I look at their feed and they've been releasing an episode for 40 straight weeks. They already have a little bit of the chops and they know the understanding of what it takes to podcast on a consistent basis. It's a little bit harder for me to validate that with someone who is interested in starting a podcast. So I'm much tougher in the sales process, really trying to explain to them what it takes to consistently produce a podcast. But yeah, at the end of the day, people that can follow a process and hit deadlines is really important to me, because if they can't, that puts a lot of stress and pressure on my production team, and they're just not going to be a good fit in the long run. It's very hard. Podcasting is very hard. You're typically looking at if you're a weekly show, you're typically looking at 8 episodes all at one time, and each one of those episodes needs to be moving through the certain stage of the production process. Some of that is content planning, some of that's recording, some of that is editing itself, or some of that might be the actual marketing of those episodes. And if people can't juggle multiple episodes at a time and make sure they're hitting the timelines for each one of the responsibilities that fall on their plate, the wheels are going to fall off and things are going to burn out pretty quickly here.
Man, you're stressing me out with all the work that a podcast takes. So there's a lot of stuff going on. Like, can you try to articulate like how much work would go into like one episode? Just so people have an idea.
Yeah. So if I'm about to work on a new episode, I need to think about what is the concept or what's the idea for the episode. If I'm going to have a guest, I'm going to have to think through who is the right person to have this conversation with. If I don't know that person, I'm going to have to cold pitch them. Even if I know them, I'm still going to need to reach out to them and work through calendars and scheduling. Then comes recording day. If I'm recording with someone else, we're going to have a conversation just like this. If I'm recording on my own, I'm probably building a specific outline or script and recording on my own. Either way, I'm probably doing some research and preparation for the episode between getting it scheduled and actually recording it. And then the fun really starts. You're probably about at the tip of the iceberg right there. You press stop. And now after this episode is done, Doug's got to put it into production. So he's got to have to download files, upload them to wherever his team's got to grab them. The team has got to go through at least one, maybe two rounds of editing. It's taking out the ums, the ahs, the you knows, looking for pacing, looking for false starts, doing all the audio engineering so it's leveled and sounds correctly. Maybe handing it back to him for review, then getting it back for a final edit. And then once the edit is done, we have to then start working on the packaging, the thumbnail, the title, the show notes. Someone has to draft and write that, approve that. And then at the end of the day, you press schedule. It's got to be done, or at least that's what you think. Now you have to get people to listen to that episode. So then there's typically another process at the very end of this where you're going to take a couple of steps, either putting it into your email newsletter, creating posts for social media to promote these episodes, and then maybe even thinking about podcast strategy larger than that too. And like, how are you going to get new people to come out, check out your show, you know, reaching out to people you don't know, getting on their shows, running paid ad strategies, etc. There is a lot that goes into just one episode. And then on top of that, managing your podcast in general.
It's a good summary. good summary. You know, the crazy thing, Justin, so I have this show and I have Mile High Fi. Mm-hmm. For a few years, I was doing two episodes per show per week. So four. And I did have an editor, but yeah, there was, as you're talking about it, I'm like, oh shit, that was a lot, man. It was totally a lot. And it was awesome to cut it down to one episode per week for each one. And I was like, oh yeah, I can do less.
Yes.
Which is, it felt great.
Honestly, I love putting new clients through, you know, new launch clients through the ringer and trying to keep them on a weekly episode cadence as long as they can, because eventually they might move to bi-weekly and then they feel like it is the easiest thing to do to create one. I get 2 weeks to do what I was doing in 1 week. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, yeah. I mean, when I look back at like the sheer number of episodes, it's mind-boggling, and I'm like, I'm not big on streaks, which is, I think, it's good because it could be a little unhealthy. And I have a streak for both of the shows, like never missed a week, and for a long time, I was doing two episodes per. There's some tricks, you know, you could rebroadcast, you could do a remix or something like that, but at the end of the day, like you said, I mean, there's no shortcuts. There's just like a lot of pieces of the process, so... I know one thing that I've done, even from the beginning, I'm like, if I am going to sustain this, I need to change the scope and just like, at the end of the day, it ends up being like lowering the quality. Yes. Unfortunately, like it's all trade-offs, right? So like either I have to put in all the time and do all the pieces that you're talking about, or the quality will be a little lower. And I'm like, the quality is a little lower, but I'm extremely consistent. You can't have everything.
I think that's actually a really great point to make here. And it's something that I talk about a bunch. You know, at the end of the day, I do think consistency is what's going to drive a lot of podcast growth and a lot of audience development. And I like to work through trying to help, especially my existing podcasters that come to me, audit their whole workflow and figure out what's actually providing ROI and what's not, and then dropping or removing some things. A lot of times that might be getting rid of video because video adds a lot of complexity. It forces people to be at a studio. It doubles the download time for files. It requires you to be camera ready. There's so many other elements to it, but I like to talk through a bunch of different things like that. You know, some clients of mine think you have to record for 40 minutes. And I like to be like, what about, well, how's a 15 minute solo episode feel for you? So, you know, there are a bunch of tips and tricks that I think you could reduce your workload. If you're an online business owner right now and you're thinking about starting a podcast, I do think you could be working on a podcast 1 to 2 hours a week or 10, 15, 20 hours a week. And some of that, as Doug was alluding to, is just scope and just deciding what you actually want to put in. But you don't have to do it all, especially from the start. And you can kind of decide over time to add or remove things, which I think is nice. I've gone from weekly to bi-weekly and back to weekly. I've added video at different times. I've been posting on social media. I haven't posted on social media before. There are a lot of different things that you can decide to do or not do.
One observation with all kinds of different online business specifically is things kind of worked immediately. A lot of stuff that I tried like didn't work, and you know, you don't want to quit too early. We know sort of the compound interest of the effort and the learnings, and you stop making as many mistakes, but generally things work really quickly. What worked like right away? Did the whole concept work and you were like, okay, this is clearly a good path for us to go down?
Oh man, I want to say so many things worked well right away, but no, that's not always the case. On the sales front, in person, networking worked really well. So I doubled down on that and realized putting 3 to 5 conferences on my calendar every single year was going to drive outcome, drive sales. Dividing and conquering with my co-founder and brother Kyle worked really well right away. So we quickly tried to figure out which lane we were both best served in versus us kind of just 50-50 dividing all of the work. Like at one point in time, we tried like, you handle these 5 clients and I'll handle these 5. But we realized it shouldn't be a client division, but actually a task or responsibility or workflow division that's happening. So we actually went back to that, realizing it was working right from the get-go. Yeah, there are probably some other things that I'm just not thinking about at the top of my head right now, but I think those are probably the two big ones right at the gate that I thought about.
Okay, and perfect. And it sounds like you guys were able to communicate well and adjust and, you know, take what you learned, like, oh, we thought this and we switched back. And I take it you work pretty well with your brother too.
Yes and no. okay. Yes, in terms of sense that we're family and there's nothing that would break that bond. And our business, right from the get-go, we told ourselves the business never needs to get in between our relationship. So if we were ever struggling with that, we promised we'd just shut the business down. But on the same vein, running a business can be stressful. And with that stress comes communication failures. And a lot of times we defaulted to how we communicated with each other when we were 13 years old, not as 20 somethings, but as teenagers. So after about a year of a few blow ups, we both had to come back to the table and be like, hey, I love you. You got my back. We want this to work. How are we going to put some things in place? Just simply like, hey, you know, especially with two co-founded businesses, decision making a lot of times does turn into a 50-50 split. And we had to realize what happens when it's just two people. And we didn't want to get a third party. Like sometimes, like, I feel like I was like defaulting, be like, oh, what's my girlfriend think? Like, Gabby thinks this, we should go this way. And Kyle's like, I don't care what Gabby thinks. This is our business, not yours, or not hers. I was like, actually, that's fair. So we had to put a couple of principles in place where we would always try to come to an agreement on a decision, but the third party or the third vote that was in it was whoever owned that domain. So, you know, for him, he might come to me with a team member issue and be like, hey, I'm really struggling with the editor. They're doing this. What do you think? How do you think we should proceed? He would get my feedback. He would give me what his feedback is. And then we might come to a decision on what to do. And if that decision was split, it's his domain. He ultimately gets to decide what decision is made there. And I have to be comfortable with it. I realized early on, I had to get over the complex of wanting to be right and instead what's best for our business. And I think that was a challenge for me in year one of running a business. And then same on my side too. You know, for example, I'm in charge of pricing and packaging. So I might go to him and brainstorm or talk out pricing. I'm thinking about increasing this. What do you think? He might come back to me. I'll hear him, get his feedback. I'll share mine. But at the end of the day, if it's a split decision, it's my responsibility to make a decision and then own that responsibility. So we put a lot of those practices in place of how we communicate and who ultimately gets decisions. And I think that really helped coming out of year one and into year two of business.
So we talked on your podcast about like idleness and really just not working too hard. It's something I'm passionate about. And how do you keep yourself from working too much? And I mean, you're your own boss, so you can create the job that you want, but you're also very driven. And I'm just curious how you deal with that. The other piece of this is like, once you start working for yourself, you see like, oh, there's very little waste in the system. So there's not all these middle managers like a corporate job. So if you triple your clients, like you and your brother could be taking home like 3x and maybe not be putting in a ton more time. It scales in a way that feels surprising. So how do you embrace a lifestyle business approach?
Doug, I think this was one of the most challenging things through the evolution. You know, we talked about financial independence at the beginning of this conversation, and reaching financial independence while scaling a business was a bit of a dichotomy, because at the end of the day, I wanted to reach financial independence so I could work a little bit less and I could have more ownership of my time. And I needed to implement that with my business. But it wasn't just my business, it was also my brother's business. And he's on a different path in his own financial journey too right now. So of course, he would love for us to be 10x where we're at right now. I would love to be right where we're at right now, because I like the container that it's currently in. So there is some trade-offs and some some back and forth that him and I have to talk through on that front. But there are a couple of things that I put into place that have really allowed me to contain this to a lifestyle business, maybe 25 to 30 hours a week. And those hours, for the most part, are fairly flexible hours. For the most part, work at the same time most of the week, but it's nice on a random Tuesday if I want to just do an hour of work and then shut the laptop down and not think about anything else for the rest of the day and go on my merry way. So a couple of things that I did: time blocking meetings, places that I needed to be at certain times. I tried to contain them to three hour time blocks, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So client meetings, networking meetings, sales calls, it's nice putting them there. So I had maximum flexibility for the other, 15, 20 hours a week that I needed to work to spend or spread out how I wanted to. Also making a list of five important tasks that I wanted to do that week. It's very easy as a business owner to just keep adding to the to-do list and saying, hey, I need to do this and this and this this week. On Mondays, sometimes Sunday nights, I look down and I say, hey, if I only got five things done this week, what should those five things be? And then whenever I check those five things off for the week, I don't beat myself up if I decide I don't want to do or work on any other things related to my business. And then always auditing and dropping non-producing tasks is also important. Like, what was I doing just because I thought it was the right thing to do, or I thought it might be adding some value to the business, but it wasn't adding any value to the business. Always questioning and asking those things that I was doing, especially the things that weren't ongoing, but maybe like monthly or quarterly. I'm like, do any of my clients check their analytics worksheets that I'm updating them on every single month? And I'd ask them, and some of them are like, I never look at that and I don't really care. And some are like, yeah, I do. I really like that. And it's great overview for me. So I'm like, okay, cool. I'll just drop doing all of these and I'll only do these couple right here that really care about this. Yeah. So working through each one of those, I think has been really helpful for me too.
One question I didn't put on the list here is around exiting or selling the business. And towards the end of my online business efforts, I was like, I think building an agency, business models were shifting, but like, I think building an agency and then selling it would be like one of the most profitable, especially if you knew that you were going to sell it and you were not a critical piece in that business. It would be a great sort of turnkey situation for someone who maybe wanted to, you know, stop their corporate job and they had whatever, a few $100,000 to buy a business. So have you guys talked about that, or is that on your radar at all? Like your brother buying you out or something?
Yeah, definitely on our radar, either direction. Both of us would offer it to each other before we would offer it to someone else or get somebody else involved. We've also done a lot of strategic networking with freelancers or other agency owners that at any point in time, we wanted to throw the cards on the table and have that conversation. I would probably already have about 5 to 6 people I would turn to and ask if they have interest in it.
Perfect. That's great. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the best things. It's like, there's competitors out there, but like, you kind of want to be friends. Like those folks are the people that may buy you one day if you want it, or you buy them or whatever. So it's good not to be a jerk to other folks.
I love networking with other editors or agency owners. I think there's a lot of wisdom to learn from other people and stay on top of things. But yeah, there's also at the end of the day, this little thought in the back of my head, who would I hand this off to? Like, who would I love to sell this to? Because I'm so invested and involved in many of my clients, as a podcast producer and working with some of these clients of mine. We might be like a fraction of their marketing team, or maybe all of their marketing team. And we've been invested in new services that they're providing, changes that are happening in their business. Many of my clients, I actually consider friends first, which can be dangerous, but I'm down to play in the space of working and having friendships with my clients. So if I did ever sell the business, I would want to know that I'm handing it to someone that I really trust and that will care just as much as we care, because I care about these people that I've been working with now, some 4 or 5 years at this point.
Are you good on time if we go just a couple of minutes over?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm wide open the rest of the day, man.
Perfect. This is the last thing for me too. So, cool. Okay. I want to shift into a couple industry things, partially like my own interest in I've read some of the research out there, but it, you know, it's hard to get data on the podcasting industry. So the first one, kind of a slam dunk, most likely, is the podcast industry still growing?
Actually, it's funny that you asked that, because I just read an article this morning that had some data around this. The podcast consumption over the last decade has 4x'd. So there's either four times as many listeners, and or listeners are consuming four times what they were consuming. And year over year, podcast consumption growth is up 5%, which is great. Like, at the end of the day, hopefully your show is growing 5%. Because just naturally, the industry is growing at that rate. So yes, I think it is definitely still growing. But the caveat that I put on it, it is way more competitive than it was 5, 6, 7 years ago. I started podcasting in 2019. And it was starting to develop at that point in time. And it was really starting to take some shape, I think, especially going into 2020, when so many of the business owners got locked in their houses over COVID and were like, what should I do to grow my business? And like, there was a flood of podcasters. You can see all the stats on new shows, and 2020 and 2021, there was huge spikes in new shows because so many people were getting into podcasting. And then so many of them faded out, but what was left was experienced podcasters, and these big brands are coming into the space. There's dollars that are getting put behind podcasting right now. You can't simply just throw up a conversation with a friend and assume you're going to get thousands of downloads now. You have to really be thinking about a specific target market, the production of your show, driving a great conversation, or shaping a really good episode. It's just in my 6 years in this space, I have seen how much it has changed from the beginning to now.
Totally. And I started in 2019 also, and I felt so behind. I was like, oh, I wish I would have started in, I mean, I thought of doing a podcast on beer actually in like 2009, because that was the first shows that I listened to. It was like about home brewing in like 2007. An avid listener for about 5 or 6 years. To your point, like, people could just record something, horrible quality, like no direction. It was a beer related podcast, so a lot of times I would just be drunk. So I mean, it was kind of a train wreck, but it was funny. It was cool, and it worked. But yeah, it's so crazy that like we started in 2019 and we're ahead. I mean, like, we've kept doing it, so there's some certainly value in that. But I mean, the early shows that I was listening to, there was no other podcast basically in comparison. Okay. So with platforms, for my shows, I see Apple Podcasts and Apple products seem to be the vast majority, maybe like 60, 70%. But there's Spotify. I talk to some people and they think Spotify is the only thing out there. I'm like, I don't use Spotify. I don't care. And it's super interesting. And then YouTube is huge. I think they're now the biggest, but there's a few studies out there, but your observations and then what you have read perhaps in that study that you mentioned.
Yeah, one follow-up thought. It is unbelievable that you even knew what a podcast was in 2007, yeah, let alone listened to podcast at that time. Another really fun chart that you can Google is how many Americans understood the word podcast and what that was. And it's like that time frame, it was like 11 or 12% of the population knew what a podcast was. And now today, it's like 78, 79% or something, I think was the last thing that I saw. And you see it showing up in media now. Like, there are like shows that reference podcasts. There are like, Selena Gomez TV show that like the whole concept was them like having a podcast. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. It's Steve Martin and Martin Short, and it's Only Murders in the Building or something like that.
Yeah. That's crazy. Like that concept is insane that came into TV. So cool that you were an early consumer of podcast. But back to your question about platforms. YouTube makes this really fuzzy and really muddy, because I've seen a lot of the same studies that YouTube consumes like 80% of podcast listening, and then other studies that show it at like 17%, and Apple and Spotify ahead in those charts. I think part of the issue is definitions. A view on YouTube is not the same as a download on Apple, and that is not the same as a play on Spotify. So I think there are some definition adjustments that have to be made here, along with even defining what a podcast is. And there's some people in the industry that think a podcast has to be related to what is called an RSS feed, while there are other people that don't necessarily agree with that. So I think there's a lot of muddiness. But at the end of the day, I don't think it's that challenging to be on all platforms. There's a technology out there where you can essentially pay for a podcast host, you upload your episode there, and then you can connect your podcast host to all the listening platforms. And then on those listening then you can get anyone that chooses whatever listening platform they want can get access to your show. So it's a one-time setup. I don't think it's overwhelming. I'm in favor of getting it to wherever people listen to podcasts. So anytime a new listening platform comes on the table, I like to get my client's show submitted there.
Cool. And for me, when I looked at some of the research and thought about the demographics of my audience and then compared it to the demographics, it was like Apple Podcasts. I mean, they were the original directory and player out there. And it seemed to be like my audience is whatever, 35 to 55 or something like that, the majority. And there's more people that use Apple Podcasts in that demographic versus Spotify. YouTube skews younger generally. And there's overlap all over. Just interesting. Cause like when I think about it, I see a lot of my friends have, they don't have Apple devices and they have Android, and I'm like, what are you guys on? Do you have an iPhone? Are you
an iPhone? I have an iPhone. Yeah. Okay. I'm a Spotify user. I love Spotify. I actually really like it from a podcaster standpoint too. They're coming out with a lot of interesting features. They are one of the first to bring comments to podcast platforms, which is great, outside of YouTube, of course. They have been providing more and more analytics, especially listener analytics now, which is great. I can see on Spotify how many people are returning versus new listeners on every single episode, which seems like a very easy piece of data that these podcast players would give us. But aside from YouTube, as podcasters, we did not have a lot of data until recently to help equip and make better decisions. So I do like what Spotify's got going on here. But yeah, I see it. It's fun to be working on 18 shows because I can kind of compare things across the board here. And someone like, we have a leadership consultant that talks to CEOs, and his audience is primarily on Apple, probably skews a little bit older. And then I have a agency owner that speaks to freelance graphic designers, and her audience skews more Spotify related. So it's fun to see kind of how the shows attract different audiences and where those audiences are listening to their content.
Yeah. And I mean, to your point, I'm like, it's interesting when I kind of look at the data, and then at the end of the day, I'm not actually making a decision based on it or doing anything with it. But I'm like, there's a lot more people on Apple. Like, interesting. You know, I put the effort in YouTube because I started YouTube before the podcast anyway. And I have the studio, right? It's easy enough for me to just like turn on the camera and get going, but it doesn't have the same, you know what? I'm not trying to grow the show as much, but like there's more discoverability, which is like the big thing with YouTube. A lot of new folks might find you through the algorithm, but you could also become a slave to the algorithm. So it's a double-edged sword.
It is. I am appreciating Spotify is also becoming a little bit more algorithmic now, which once again, double-edged sword. It's nice because you can grow your show without a lot of your effort. You know, if you develop the right kind of audience, you understand what they're searching for, and then you build content around that, you can really grow an audience now on Spotify, which in the past, it wasn't necessarily like that. It was much more archaic in terms of how search worked. And it was mostly just the bigger shows, like the big dogs that are out there that would dominate search. But yeah, I think they're learning a little bit from YouTube. YouTube's learning a little bit from podcast players, which is great. And we're starting to see a lot of overlap between the platforms. And I think for the most part, there is good here. But I'm with you. I don't really love getting driven by the slave of an algorithm either. Like, it'd be so easy for me to make clickbaity titles, for me to double down on content that I know would perform really well, but for me doesn't excite me to create around. I don't know. As a someone that likes to talk about sustainably creating content, there are some other considerations outside of just growth that come into play.
All right. As we're wrapping up, because I realize we could just talk about this stuff all day long. It's so interesting. How important is video, maybe when you're talking to your clients? Are you pushing them that way? I mean, I think the industry is kind of moving in that direction. Video is really important, but I know it's not the only thing. So how important in your view?
I think I land on video just like I land on social media. It'd be easy for me to say yes or no to this answer. Like, I could straw man my own argument. And yes, like, we see so much push towards video. The social media platforms, like, it's video heavy now. You have an algorithm on YouTube that's really serving you from video. People like to consume on video. But then on the same side, I could say no. And I know many successful podcasters, our most successful client isn't even on video. I think at the end of the day, I like to articulate the pros and the cons. Video is much more expensive. So already, if you're considering starting a podcast and you are either money strapped or time strapped, removing video from the process should be a high consideration. You can always add it back on. You could always just record it and leave it somewhere and not even do anything with it and maybe come back to it. Also, you want to think about, is your content going to be heavily dependent on visuals? There are some kind of content creators that the visual component is a very important part, while other creators that they can get by just with audio. How do you plan to monetize? Like, what is your current skill set with video? What's your current equipment list? I think there are a lot of questions I'd want to go through with a client before I could really guide them if video is right for them or not. But overall, I definitely think there's a shift to video, but I think it's probably less important than what media and news is showcasing right now.
Justin, this has been really fun. It's good that we connected, and I want to make sure people can, you know, find your stuff. So if they want to connect with you, see what you're working on, where should they go?
SimplePod Studios is probably simplepodstudios.com is probably the easiest place if you want to check out what we have going in terms of our business. And then if you have questions, you want to just connect with me, LinkedIn is the only platform that I'm super active on. So you can find me, Justin Lee Peters, on LinkedIn. Connect with me, tell me that you heard me on Doug's show, and start a conversation, because I love chatting with people on LinkedIn outside of the people that just spam you with a sales DM immediately.
That's usually what I see over there. And you have a podcast too, and I'll link up to that. So yes. And what's that called?
If you're interested in podcasting, Podcast Playbook is our show. You can find it anywhere you listen to podcasts. And if you're interested in financial independence, you can find me over at FI Minded. That's FI Minded.
All right. Awesome. I'll link up all that stuff so people could find it really easily. And thanks a lot, Justin.
Thank you so much, Doug.